You're listening to world-renowned climate justice activist Bill McKibben speaking at Washington State University in Pullman on Wednesday, April 13th, 2016.
Thank you. Now, I won't take it the slightest bit amiss if people need to leave for things and dinner and stuff like that. But if there are, and I talked for a long time, for which I apologize. Sometimes when I'm tired, I tend to rattle on. But if people have questions or comments or abuse or whatever, I mean, I laid it on pretty heavily, so you feel free to give it right back to me. It would be fine.
Hi, Bill. Thanks. That was amazing. And the pictures are just so, you know, I don't know whether to laugh or cry at this point. I think I'm actually doing a bit of both listening to you. But, you know, that pipeline.
Get right on that microphone so everyone can hear
maybe
you.
Maybe they need to turn it on.
I think it's on.
Okay. We were fighting that. I'm Canadian. I'm Albertan. Sorry. We were fighting that pipeline 30 years ago. One of the most insidious things about capital is you fight it, you shut it down, and it comes back. So Let's not think we've won that battle. You're always on the way.
Oh, yeah.
You may be further or lesser sometimes, but you're never actually completely there. I actually published a paper arguing that what we're doing or not doing about climate change now, that some of those radicals that you talk about in the oil companies should be tried by the International Criminal Court for what I called negligent genocide, because the people who are most suffering from climate change don't look like we do in this room, because they're not white. Most of the people are, you know, non-whites who are radically suffering. And the other thing that I see in your presentation, and you commented on a lot, but it's something that's absolutely really missing in the American conception of what it means to critique or work against climate change, and that is precisely the question of gender. 80% of the world's environmental activists are women. Women, 80% of them. In Ghana, 86% of what goes into the national food basket is stuff that women grow. If you leave your, you know, where you live and go to the city because you can't grow your crops anymore, you still got to eat and someone's still got to grow those crops. So there's no way that's a winning proposition. Your emphasis on the global south is absolutely heartening and one of the most hopeful things, because that seems to be where the future lies. We're the dinosaurs that are just the cancer that needs to be cut out. But what is the place of gender in this solution? I don't think we can just say the women are included. Those solar panels in Germany happened because Gender CC and other organizations went out and interviewed women in households and said, how do you know when to turn off and turn on the lights? And where do you get your power source? And it was the women at the household level who actually made the decisions that brought it about that they could get solar panels on all those houses. So, you know, how can we actually pay attention to gender? Because it's the absolutely ignored factor in the American approach. Even in conversations that I've had with people who are members of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, negotiating committees. If you could bring that message of gender, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely true, and it's and I mean, I think the good news is that it's the message is being heard more and more and more, and you see it even in structural things like the leadership of American environmental groups and stuff. All of a sudden, we're finally seeing a kind of new paradigm of who's in charge of things, including at places like 350, which is led entirely by women, pretty much, and all over the world. I'm just the volunteer senior advisor to 350, which I think is mostly just a way of them reminding me that I'm the old person engaged in this work. But you're absolutely right, all over the planet. And you're absolutely right, too, about, you know, litigation and trials and things. The most interesting thing that happened in Paris, one of them anyway, when we were there, was a really beautiful and powerful mock trial of Exxon that my friend and your countrywoman Naomi Klein and I carried out. We wanted to take the opportunity when we had people from all over the globe there to testify about what the effects of climate change were on people's lives. And most of them were women who testified. The first two I remember in particular, a Sami woman from the far north of Finland, reindeer herding culture that's been at it for many thousands of years. And she said, you know, we can't really do it anymore because the rivers don't freeze predictably. My aunt fell through and drowned last winter, you know. And the next was a young woman from the Marshall Islands where, you know, now these every high tide brings with it just the wash of water across the, said, well, you know, 2 years ago it was pretty much all the graveyards got eroded and all the, you know, bodies were floating around and stuff. And last year the tides, it just came right through the living room. And she was sort of trying to be very direct and specific and things. I said, well, tell us, but stop for a minute, just tell us what that felt like. And she paused for a minute and she said, well, you know, when the tide came through the house, one of the things it washed away was the diary I've been keeping since I was 4 or 5, you know, in a sense, just kind of erased her history. And that was a good metaphor, I think, for a lot of what's happening around the world. So the good news is that the fight to do something about it looks like the world. This is largely a leaderless movement. We have no Dr. King of the climate fight. Maybe we'd be better off if we did, but I think in certain ways there's great advantage to the fact that we don't, and that we're building a movement that looks a lot like, oddly, like the kind of energy system we're hoping for. Instead of a few centralized big things, a big power plant, something, 10 million solar panels on 10 million rooftops all interconnected. Well, much the same thing in the political movement that has been rising up. It's more like a fossil fuel resistance, you know, sprawling protean. The fossil fuel industry can deal with a few, but they big organizations taking them on, they can't deal with the fact that every time they try to take a load of drilling equipment up to Alberta, there's, you know, 10 people in Idaho sitting down on the road in front of them, you know, and then, you know, 50 farmers in Nebraska blocking their next pipeline, and, you know, on and on and on and on and on and on. So I think your sense of what the future looks like is just about right.
Bill, I'd be interested in your thoughts on two events that occurred earlier this week, two different kinds of events. One of them was the court ruling in Oregon that young people have standing. If you could comment on that. The second is the paper out in Nature on the fact that we may have really not understood climate sensitivity because of the water content of clouds, a very fundamental shift that may make 350 too high. Thoughts on those two issues would be appreciated.
Right. So first is this is a wonderful court case. One of the first really interesting legal challenges around climate stuff in this country. It comes from a team at Eugene, really were the legal masterminds behind it, and all around the country, young people filed under what's called the trust doctrine, arguing that the government had was legally obligated to hold the atmosphere as a public trust and keep it from deteriorating. And so far, sort of against people's predictions, they've survived the kind of early rounds of these court battles. They've been allowed what's called standing. And so it looks like there will be a trial of some kind, one hopes, about this, which at the very least will be a remarkable occasion. It's Jim Hansen at NASA who's been among the most important witnesses at the early and preliminary stages of all of this. And it's a reminder of his remarkable book, Storms of My Grandchildren, dedicated to his grandchildren, and one of whom, Sophie, is a plaintiff in this case. As to the new data about clouds, indeed it is disturbing. It indicates clouds have always been the hardest thing to model in climate models because they both reflect and trap heat. And depending on what kind of clouds you get, either you're trapping more heat near the surface of the planet or you're reflecting more of the sun's energy before it has a chance to reach the surface. So this new data indicates that clouds are more likely to be trapping more heat. It turns on the somewhat arcane question of what percentage of the cloud is ice and which is what percentage is liquid water and so on. But yes, not good news. We're dramatically out of balance at the moment, and we've been catching no breaks from physics so far. The most operative phrase has been over and over again, earlier than expected, you know, for every consequence that we can imagine. So that's why we need to fight as hard as we possibly can.
Hi, thanks for a lovely presentation. I spent a lot of my time wallowing in the first half of your talk, and so I was really pleased to see all of your footage of all the things going on around the world. One question I have, though, is while these are great that we stop this project and that project and things like that, at some level, it seems like it's sort of dealing with the symptoms rather than the cause. And maybe you just didn't decide to talk about this, but it seems like what I would love to hear you talk about is there any efforts, or are there a lot of efforts, or could we improve the efforts to take all this energy to, you know, focus on particular candidates that are climate deniers or whatever, the snowball-wielding guy in Congress, and affect elections so we can change it at important causal points?
Sure, and all that's, you know, in some ways going on, and there are important things, you know, there it's not, here's the dilemma. It's not that we lack for ideas, okay? We've known for 25 years, The Economist told us early on what steps would be necessary to take. Prominent among them, putting a price on carbon that reflects the damage it does in the atmosphere. And there are people here from groups like Citizens Climate Lobby that have worked hard to persuade Congress to do that. It's not that there's any real logical objection to any of that. Economists left, right, and center have described it as a necessary idea. That's not the problem. The problem is political. The problem is the political power of the fossil fuel industry. So the work that we do is largely designed to break the power of the fossil fuel industry, to make it so that it's no longer strong enough to block logic and common sense. Because at the moment, I mean, you can go to Congress all you want and talk to people, but you're not going to get anywhere for the moment. I mean, and that's because the fossil fuel industry has invested huge amounts of money in making sure of that. The Koch brothers, our biggest oil and gas barons on the planet, taken together, the two of them, the richest man on Earth, okay, have announced plans to spend $900 million on this year's election. That's more than the Republicans or the Democrats spent on the last election. Koch brothers' party of two, okay? And the reason they're doing it is to make sure that nothing happens to change their ability to keep minting money from hydrocarbons. So I think that for the moment, the most efficient task is to try and break that power. And we do it sometimes by playing defense, as with all these projects, which make their life much more difficult. And we do it also by playing offense. That's what this divestment campaign is about around the world. And I hope that, though this will be a hard place to do it, I hope people will take it up here. The University of Washington's begun divesting from, at least from coal and tar sands, and that's a good sign. The other thing that you guys could do here that would be of use, there's a real active campaign to get the Attorney General of the state of Washington to join the Attorney Generals of New York and California and Massachusetts in the investigation of Exxon, which is very important. And so if you had a moment to write a note to the AG in the state of Washington, whose name I've forgotten for the moment, somebody must know who your Attorney General is. He's announced that they're going to be talking about climate change, but he hasn't yet said we're going to take on Exxon, which we need him to do. But Ferguson, okay, you've got your marching orders. Just send it to him, care of the Capitol, and it'll get through.
Well, here's some envelopes with stamps on them you can use to write.
Ah, there's a good organizer. All right.
And make a little folder and keep track of your monthly letters. What do you think about fee and dividend, something we can actually do and actually ask for? And if we have 2,000 people asking for something so normal and logical like that, every single month in every single congressional district, it will make a difference. They are wondering what's going on when they get 12 letters a month on a topic. We can send in 2,000 and get something passed.
And the Citizens Climate Lobby, who is really the people doing the bulk of that work in the U.S. Congress, is a very useful operation to work with and support. Because you're right. I mean, people worry all the time about apathy and say, oh, it's so apathetic. We're so apathetic. How will anything ever happen? The good news is that apathy cuts both ways, okay? So if you make a noise, chances are there's not that many people making a noise on the other side. And that works to your advantage.
You're listening to world-renowned climate justice activist Bill McKibben speaking at Washington State University in Pullman on Wednesday, April 13th, 2016.
Well, it looks like we have two more questions here, and then you'll mercifully be allowed to leave my depressing company for a while. And
first, thank you very much. And I wonder, since you're like the main guy, go-to guy for climate, would you be willing to put your shoulder to the wheel on the issue of secrecy? I don't think we would be in the pickle we're in today except for the problem of secrecy. And recently they instituted non-disclosure agreements for people in NOAA and the Weather Bureau, and it just seems ridiculous, and these should be lifted. And a lot of it is to, I think, prevent exposure of the geoengineering program. And I think we have this kind of single focus on CO2, but how can we look at things like the Arctic, the stripping out of the Arctic ice was such a shock, but how can you look at that, not look at the ionospheric heating from the HAARP installations?
The other thing beyond CO2 to really look at, the other thing that we now realize is driving climate change at a rapid rate is methane. And you mentioned the Arctic, and that's one of the places it's going. It's why the opposition to fracking's been so important. If you're interested in all of this, I had the cover story in The Nation magazine 2 or 3 weeks ago. It's a very detailed examination of just how much methane we've managed to put out. Enough, because we've gone in so whole hog for fracking for natural gas, that it looks like it may have been enough that it canceled out whatever decreases in carbon dioxide we've managed to get over the last 10 years, and that America's greenhouse gas emissions may have remained more or less stable or even gone up, which is not at all what we've been telling ourselves or what we told the world at Paris. So these are good things, and you're absolutely right. This is an issue on which transparency would be, as with many other issues, is our friend. I watched my good friend Jim Hansen at NASA struggle for 20 years against president after president and administrator after administrator, trying to keep him from testifying, trying to keep him from saying the truth. Now, he happily had a high enough profile and enough people behind him and enough guts, most importantly, that he was able to kind of keep doing it. But for everyone like that, there's doubtless 1,000 more government scientists and others who just feel like they can't tell what they know. So it's a very good point.
Hi, Bill. A quick correction and then a quick question. So I'm from the divestment campaign down at the University of Washington. We only divested from coal, unfortunately, not tar sands.
Okay, good.
And then the question is, given the current blockage in at Congress at the national level, I'm wondering what you think about the possibility of taking action at the state level. So currently here at the currently here in Washington State, we have an initiative 732, which is trying to put a price on carbon, which James Hansen actually just endorsed himself. So what do you think of the possibility of moving to state by state level action?
So you can do some of this state by state, and it can be useful. As you know, the resolution here in Washington, sadly, people were unable to unite around a kind of common, which I think is a big problem. I think we have unity within movements is very key. And so the fact that communities of color and things felt they couldn't support it makes it more difficult to figure it out. But you can do things state by state, and that's useful. It's probably more useful as a kind of educational tactic in order to get us working at national and international levels. There are a few places that are big enough that, I mean, California being the kind of prime example, and so those who are kind of joining with California in these ongoing compacts to in some way put a price on carbon and spur things are beginning to make some progress, and that's really good. One of the reasons we need to do things federally also is that we need very much to convince the Chinese and the Indians that we're serious about what we're doing, because we very much need them though they did not really cause this problem, to take a huge and active role in solving it. And it is exquisitely difficult to do that when they see the people who bear historical responsibility doing their best to shirk it in one way or another. So thank you for being engaged here and at work on that. And thank you all very much for bearing with all of this. Oh.
So before you, before we make our exit, I would like to just invite and encourage any students in the group in remaining to come forward. If you have a question, now's the time to ask it. Don't be afraid. Don't be intimidated by the amount of facial hair you see on most of the people remaining in the audience, and I'm talking about you, yes, and me. This is a big opportunity for you. So if you have a question or a comment for Bill McKibben, the microphone is yours. Let's give him about 15 seconds to feel uncomfortable.
And I think we get also some chance to talk with students tomorrow, too, and which will be good. I'll look forward to that. There you go.
There you go. Oh, that's too much facial hair. It's all right. Come on over.
Well, thanks a lot. And studied outdoor leadership at the McCall Outdoor Science School in Idaho. And part of our mantra there is to not instill students or young students, primarily fifth and sixth graders, with this idea of this doomsday mantra, right? We're trying to instill them with this sense of love and appreciation for their surrounding environment so they could first fall in love with it and then create their own relationship with it. And then from there, be an activist, be a fighter for it. That's my first
part. I think you're exactly on the right track. I'm always getting things from like children's book authors wanting to do like picture books about climate change and stuff, and I'm always saying, don't do this. Up to a certain age, the only job is to get people to fall in love with the world around them, because we protect that which we love, and we don't, I mean, just think about your own lives. The odds of falling in love with someone who's terminally ill requires more character than most of us actually possess, you know? So, a very radical and useful thing to do is take someone out camping who's never done it before.
Yeah, well said. And one more thing, we study this model that includes a designated leader, and not just followers, but active followers, people who are following but making their own steps in this movement. And you know, I think that's us. But I would say to you, you know, you humbly brag or humbly demote yourself, but man, I see it in your eyes. I see the passion that you have, the honesty, and you were given this knowledge for a reason, you know, and I thank you for that so much. And you have a huge responsibility on your shoulders, but man, we are following you. We are not alone. We are actively following you. And we're fighting with you. I just want you to let you know that.
Thank you, brother. That is very good to hear. And you know, I've thought a fair amount about these sort of questions of leadership in recent years, and I do think that the, you know, for those of us who've done it a long time, the kind of role to think about is the role of not exactly leader, but of kind of elder, able to kind of point in the right direction. I spend a lot of my time trying to identify people who are coming up doing amazing things. There's many days when I think the most useful work I do in the day is, for some reason, I've acquired this enormous Twitter following, and I can use it to point out the good work that others are doing and kind of get people there, to their Kickstarters, to their books, to their symposiums, to their, you know, sit-ins, to whatever it is. It is really inspiring now to see how much, I mean, every single day there's 15 different places around the world where people are going to jail, and, you know, 50 different places where people are thinking of really interesting creative action to support what change needs to come, and so on. So it's good fun, and thank you for being part of it.
No, thank you. Appreciate it.
So I was just wondering, can I, is that close enough? So we have potential leaders of this country, right, who still claim continuously that climate change is made up or make believe or a lie. So I was just wondering if they do come to power, how to, I guess, have any hope to, you know, continue the hope besides activists and stuff to actually solve this. Oh, voting, obviously, but I'm just wondering,
this it's a very good question.
Yeah, with the history of this whole, you know,
it's a very
voting issues, that how are we supposed to, I guess, maintain the hope?
So one way to think about it is, it's very important to vote and be engaged in elections. Mm-hmm. Election day is, you know, one day a year. The other 364 days are just as politically important. Like, whoever is in there, then you have to go, nothing happens for free. You've got to go push them, okay, all the time, no matter who. So it'll be harder if it's, you know, Donald Trump or something. around. But, you know, I'll confess, I've spent much of the summer campaigning and helping my my Vermont countryman, Mr. Sanders. It's a great pleasure to be alive in the only moment when being a aging, graying Vermonter will be a very sexy thing, you know. But I introduced him the day he launched his campaign on the shore of Lake Champlain. His introducers were me and Ben and Jerry, okay? But I said, I'm so hopeful you win, and you can count on the fact that the day after you win, I'll probably be there, you know, chaining myself to the White House that you're occupying, because we're going to need to push you too. And he was, to his credit, there's nothing that would make him happier than that. The cruelest thing one could do would be to elect Bernie Sanders and then just walk away, you know, or anyone. So our work ultimately, I think, the final end of everything that we're doing, and the pictures that I've shown you, and the, you know, the real end is to kind of change the zeitgeist of the country. And when that happens, then who's elected makes somewhat less difference than it did before. Look at the last big change in our zeitgeist in this country, which was around gay marriage, okay? As little ago as 4 years ago, it wasn't just Ted Cruz who was against gay marriage. Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were against gay marriage, okay? But activists did such a good job of changing the zeitgeist, changing the way that we thought about this, okay? Not by electing new people, essentially all the same people are still there, but by all the kinds of brilliant organizing that they did, that now, you know, even most conservative Republicans just like wish the whole thing would go, issue would go away, no longer interest, because they know it's a losing proposition, you know? And we're starting to reach that point with climate change. The Republicans are gonna have to run on climate denial this fall, because their money comes from the Koch brothers and things, are not happy about that anymore. They know it's a weakness, and they're gonna have to spend a lot of time explaining why they somehow are, you know, don't believe in physics and chemistry, you know, which is a difficult explanation to make increasingly. So that's our work. And I thank you so much for that question, because it really goes to the heart of things, and I should have sort of said it before. Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Thank you all.
You've been listening to world-renowned climate justice activist Bill McKibben speaking at Washington State University in Pullman on Wednesday, April 13th, 2016.